Aaron. It's 6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah.
Good morning, geniuses, philosophers, kings and queens, working class heroes, self-designated leaders of the collective we, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and the few conservatives that enjoy to listen to us for entertainment. Riley just went into some strange muscle man dance. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning. I'm just feeling my oats. Thank you very much.
He's sitting in his chair with his Raiders shirt on, flexing away.
That's right.
Did you go to the gym?
Hey, team sucks, but what the hell?
Did you go to the gym or something?
I went yesterday.
You did?
I did go to the gym yesterday.
Oh,
worked out for a little while.
How do you like that?
I enjoyed it, man. You know, I hadn't done anything since before I went on vacation, so it was like maybe 3 weeks, almost a month, I hadn't been in the gym.
I got to be honest with you, I'd love to see the Mark Riley workout. I'd really like to see it.
It's very simple.
I'm sure.
I do 10 minutes on a stationary bike.
Yeah.
I do some, you know, leg exercises, crunches, a few other things on the machine.
Mm-hmm.
I do a few laps in the pool, and I jump in the whirlpool and the sauna, and I'm done. It's an hour.
I get the feeling that the sauna and the whirlpool is the thing you're moving towards. That's the high point.
High point of the whole thing.
Yeah.
A couple of laps in the pool. As a matter of fact, a lap and a half, if I'm tired, I'm out.
I go straight
into the whirlpool.
Yeah, why not? I sat and thought about the gym.
Really?
A lot of times I just do that. I get into this sort of like weird kind of like self-flagellating, not, you know, in the mental way, where I'm just sitting on or just sitting on the couch and sort of like, oh, just go. Just do it. It's only an hour. And then it's like, no, I can't.
Is this with the two Marins, one on each shoulder?
Oh, yeah.
The guy
yeah.
in the blue saying, come on, man, you know you need
thank
to
God,
eat.
Thank God the one in the red is tired out. You know, he's not as bad as he used to. But I went to the fish store yesterday. I got a thing for fish, man. I got a thing for looking at fish.
Really?
I got a thing for, I just like seeing fish laying there. It's not so much that they're...
Oh, man, you've done it now.
I know.
Here we go.
I just realized that right when it came out of my 25 mouth.
25 blogs about your insensitivity about our seagoing creatures.
I got to eat something. And the truth of the matter is, I just felt like a Wayne Gilman there for a second. I got to eat something. But I went to the fish store, and there's this huge fish head. It was a head the size of a human head just sitting on the ice there.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's the biggest salmon I ever saw. And the guy says, no, it's striped bass. I'm like, that's striped bass. And there was some, I wanted a part of that fish.
Really?
So I got a part of that fish, and I cooked it with garlic and parsley, and it was good, Riley.
You didn't take the head, though.
I didn't take the head. I don't know what the hell to do with the head. You know, they always
make fish soup out of the head, I guess.
Well, that's what people do, but I don't know how to do that. You know, it's a real pain. You know, and I cooked salmon 2 days ago, and I had to have professional fumigators come in.
Was it eyeballs in?
No, I don't. Well, the eyeballs were in the head, but I didn't take the eyeballs
home.
No, I haven't cleaned the fish.
Oh.
But I cooked salmon the other day, and I just couldn't believe it. That's why it's such a popular restaurant item, because if you cook that stuff at home, it's over, man.
Yeah.
I mean, your place is going to smell like salmon for a week.
Set off the fire alarm.
I did that, too. The new fire alarm, I set it off, and I had to take that out.
Really?
Unbelievable. Yeah, I live an exciting life, friend.
Me too, but you know what? I'm not as anxious as I used to be. Like, you know, I always have anxiety about being late, about not being prepared, and all. And for some reason, this last vacation, man, I'll tell you that.
I noticed that about you. I don't know what it was, but there was a significant change when you came back, and I felt it as well. I don't know what it was. I think we just settled in or something.
I think it is.
We've got the groove. You know, we're going along pretty good. Like this morning, I woke up at 2:30 our time, Eastern time, just sort of like, all right, time for work.
Time to go.
And then that was followed by like, oh no, I got to sleep more, and then went away.
And then I kind of like swing myself on the edge of the bed about the time I figure I need to sleep more.
Well, I think the thing is with anybody who has a job, at some point, if you like the job and you want to continue the job, you just accept whatever schedule it is that you are working on, and that's your job, as opposed to thinking like, I'm missing this, I'm missing that, I can't do this, I can't do that. You know, you just accept it.
This is your work. Deal with it.
I mean, I got an email, someone, a baker. We have a woman who's a baker out in Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to be honest with you. This is a part of me. I wish I was a baker.
Really?
I've always had a certain amount of envy for people who work those kind of jobs, who cook or bake in the middle of the night. There's a piece to do. Could you just imagine getting up 2:30? Here we come in and we talk and we aggravate people and enlighten people and entertain
whatever else
people.
We do. Yeah.
But could you just imagine like going into work at 2:30 and just reigning over a vat of dough and just making the muffins?
Hey,
and
you know, it's funny you mention that, because there is a bakery on my way to work that I go past.
No
every morning. Yeah, you can smell it.
Best.
And the thing is, you know, they got the big double doors open because it's this place, Balthazar. They deliver all, you know, restaurants all over the city.
Yeah.
So usually about 3 o'clock in the morning, the big door, the garage door is open. They're, you know, I guess putting stuff on the trucks and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's also one of these big tractor-trailer places, a food, I forgot the name of it, but it's a food company. You know, they got, like, margarine and mayonnaise and stuff, so they're doing deliveries. So when I go down this particular street, it's like the middle of rush hour because there's trucks coming out of here and trucks pulling into Balthazar. But it's a great thing to smell. You should go up to the Bronx one day and smell the Stella Dora plant. It's still there.
I should take a special trip for that?
A special trip, because if you ever like the smell of, like, you know, baking cookies.
Well, you know, when I was a kid in New Jersey, my grandmother lived in New Jersey, and I grew up when I was very young, you know, before we moved away when I was like 6. The Nabisco factory, I think it's on 23, or used to be on 23 or 17 or one of those.
I think it was on 17.
Yeah.
I think it's off 17.
So, you know, we'd drive by there. My grandma would always roll down the windows and go, okay, see if you could smell the cookies.
Ooh.
And I think we could. I don't know. It seemed reasonable. I mean, I saw the plant there, and you see the Nabisco. It's like, okay, I guess so. But I can definitely smell the bakery across the street, Frank's Bakery out in Astoria. But I have always had a certain amount of, I think that I secretly want to be a cook.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe another life. Maybe later. I don't know.
Let me tell you.
What?
As great as that smell is, if you've ever been in an apartment house in New York City where there's a lot of different types of
I
people.
I live in it, man.
All right. So one floor's got curry.
Exactly.
The next floor's got Dominican food.
Yeah,
the floor below that's got ribs.
It's usually garlic on one floor, curry on another floor, and then, you know, whatever that weird smell is. you know what it is?
Bay leaves.
The questionable smell.
Yeah.
So, you know, in light of this, in light of what we're talking about, I wanted to talk about Social Security. We're going to talk to Paul Krugman later, but for my own self, because I was asking you before we got on the air here, and we do have a surprise special mystery guest.
Yes, we do.
Break, which is going to be kind of fun. But what I'm thinking about is I've never thought about retirement until recently. You know, when I was younger, you know, because, I mean, Bush went in front of a bunch of young people. It's a quote-unquote young people, you know, whoever they recruited. And he was trying to scare them into believing that there wouldn't be money for them. But I got to be honest with you. When I was a kid, and even up until maybe a year ago, I never thought about retirement. I guess maybe I'm irresponsible. But, I mean, at what point do you really start thinking about that, you know?
This is a tough sell that he's trying to do because first of all, a lot of these young people, whether they believe Social Security will be there for them or not, it is not the primary means by which they plan on living their retirement years.
Yeah.
All right? They got IRAs. They got this.
Hopefully.
They got that.
Well, that's what you were saying. That's what I was asking you. And you say that there's a cap on Social Security.
Yeah.
After a certain point, like, you know, $90,000.
Around $90,000.
So really, Social Security is designed to help people that may not have an umbrella of some sort or another plan or an IRA or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have those things. And that's why it has to remain in place exactly the way it is, you know, that maybe taxes have to be elevated a little bit to compensate for some of the shortcomings in the future. But it's for people that don't have that other option. I mean, I just started trying to save money for my retirement. I'm 41 years old.
Let me tell you something. What Bush is doing here is shameless scamography and trickeration, the words of Don King.
We're definitely going to flesh that out very effectively today with Krugman later in the show. After this, you know, one of my comic, definitely.
Don't say it. Don't say it.
All right.
Surprise mystery guest.
Okay, 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
I'm the Reverend Al Sharpton, reminding you that listening to any radio show besides Morning's Edition is officially considered selling out to the man. So keep it tuned here to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it is Wednesday. I hope you're having an okay day. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
I mean, I would hope it's not screwed up yet. It's only 19 past the hour. It's morning. It's still dark here. My heart goes out to everybody on this planet today that is suffering from some heavy weather, man.
What's going on this planet?
I tell you, man, you watch CNN, it's almost like the Apocalypse News Network. The only thing that they haven't covered is locusts.
It's unbelievable because, you know, you see these scenes of devastation. A lot of times when we're, you know, preparing for the show, we actually watch the monitor with the sound off, and we can't figure out where the devastation is actually taking place. Are they showing tsunami footage? Are they showing Southern California?
Yeah.
Are they showing Utah? Are they showing New Jersey? We don't know.
Well, as far as I know, I talked to my wife this morning. My house is not slid down the hill. There has not been a mudslide in my area, but man, that footage of that mudslide on the out in Ventura County was mind blowing. I feel bad for those people.
Oh man,
it's just it's like out of nowhere. You don't expect that to happen. And then I was starting to talk to you a little bit when we're sitting here working on the show. Before the show, and you heard an alarm. I didn't hear the alarm. And you realize that, you know, even with warning, you know, it's going to take people a few minutes to get past that 15 minutes of like, hey, we think, should we go?
Should we go? Yeah,
I mean,
should
I don't
we
know.
Leave
is,
the
is it real or what? Is there someone in the car that's still on? It'll go off in a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, how long is it really going to take? I mean,
until the guy downstairs wakes up.
Until something happens, did he smell something or see something? It's pretty scary stuff, but apparently out there with that mudslide, they had no warning whatsoever, and there was some indication that they knew that that mountain was a potential mudslide, you know, and yet the real estate speculators still build.
In California, they build anywhere.
I'll tell you, man, I mean, living out there, you just see people, it's almost like, you know, what's this gated community called? Defying God neighborhood. You know what I mean? It's like they will stick houses, like, into cliffs. Just
well, they'll build
right
pontoons
there
out in the Pacific Ocean and put people out there if you buy the real estate.
They're just sitting there. It's like, what do you got? Come on, bring it. We're going to be all right.
Yeah, your home in the hills suddenly becomes beachfront property.
I got a little house, and Pashman was saying, you know, is it insured or what? And I'm like, I think so. You never know with your insurance coverage.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Everything's too complicated for me sometimes to understand, Riley.
Let me explain something to you. It's not that it's too complicated. It's that the insurance companies will, they adjust what they insure to fit the circumstances.
Yeah.
So that, you know, and the circumstances have to be in their favor.
Well, that's it.
So they pay out as little as possible.
Can't get any earthquake insurance unless your car is anchored. And I mean, not your car. I mean, your house is what do they call it? Bolted down, they say.
Yeah.
And they didn't bolt things down until the big quake of whenever it was. But my house was built in like the 20s, and this little house is not bolted down. So theoretically, it could just slide away. I don't know. You got to pay a bunch of money to get it bolted down, then you can get the earthquake insurance. But new houses are built, bolted, whatever. You know.
Well, see, that's an important point. Because if California contractors work the same way New York and New Jersey contractors do, you may pay them to bolt down your house and still watch it float off because they didn't do the work right.
That's true. That's always a possibility. You got a houseboat.
Yep.
Speaking of this, I mean, I wonder if our president, being that he is a religious man, is looking at the footage on CNN, is looking at his 4 or 15 monitors out there at the Western White House in Crawford or wherever the hell he is, and actually saying, this is it. Our time has come. The apocalypse is here, because he's a deep believer, Riley.
He's watching sports on those
really
monitors.
He's watching reruns
of the football playoffs.
There was an interview in the Washington Times. This is, of course, Reverend Sung Young Moon's publishing arm. we're gonna have to do a whole show on him, because I want to do some research. I want to know more about the moon conspiracy. But apparently, he said a couple of things here that I find a little disconcerting. How about you, Riley?
He is. You know, with this guy, nothing surprises anymore.
Yeah.
It is a little disconcerting, because it gives you kind of a window into how George W. Bush plans to get done everything that's on his agenda for this second term, from Social Security to immigration to all of these different issues that he has on his plate.
Yeah.
He is going to attack them all precisely the same way. And
except for God.
Except for God.
He's
yeah.
never going to attack God. Mr. Bush said that, unlike many Christians, he does not think that faith is under attack by culture at large, and points to the backlash against attempts to further secularize the public square as proof. Quote, the great thing about our country is somebody can stand up and say, we should try to take under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance, end quote. Mr. Bush said, quote, on the other hand, the backlash was pretty darn significant.
This is a country that is a value-based country. Whether they voted for you or not, there are a lot of values in this country for which I'm real proud.
What does that even mean? Here's the twisted doublespeak one that I like, though. I think people attack me because they're fearful that I will then say that you're not equally as patriotic if you're not a religious person. I've never said that. I've never acted like that. I think that's just the way it is. So this is all in reaction to Michael Newdow's desire. This is the guy that went up against the Supreme Court to try and get the pledge changed, and this is the guy who is now saying that the inauguration ritual,
yes,
which it is, the ritual of having a Christian prayer said and putting your hand on the Bible is not, it blurs the line between church and state.
Which it actually does. I mean, on that level, it does. And I say that as a religious person, such as I am.
But a lot of people just dismiss this stuff as sort of like, hey, come on. It's just, you know, it's just the way it is. It's just, it's part of it.
It's been like this for a million, billion, trillion years.
Right.
So therefore, it should not change. Let me tell you something. Part of the greatness of this country, and this is something that George W. Bush will never admit in his entire life, but part of the greatness of this country is being able to constantly question the country's widely held precepts. If that were not the case, black people would still be slaves in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were people at the time that there were was a great deal of agitation for abolition. But, well, hey, man, we've had slaves for 200 years. What's the problem?
Right. They're okay.
Yeah, they're okay.
Go
they
ask
enjoy
them.
It.
Yeah.
Right. We're educating them. They have a charmed life compared to being in Africa. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that people used to say.
Right, and people were so terrified that, you know, to stand up, you know, in any way where they'd risk their lives. So, you know, they were able to, you know, keep it. It's an awful way that they maintain a status quo.
Yeah.
You know, they frighten some people, they terrorize some people, and then defy other people to question it.
But see, what Bush is doing to me is really slick. He is putting this whole messianic / Christian aura over secular political public policy.
Well, that's why these guys have to, that's why we have to fight it. It's important that Barry Lins are out there. It's important that Newdow's out there doing this. It's important because now you can't take things for granted when you have a contingent of the populace that is fighting to, you know, to make everything religious, that is dictating, trying to dictate policy,
yes,
trying to dictate how the government works. You have to take, you can't take anything for granted anymore. And one of the great things about our guest coming up after this break, Terry Jones. Original member of Monty Python. I had a tip in it somewhere.
I know you did. I know. I just figured I'd yell.
You know, he's got a new book out about he's taken up the war on terror. It's Terry Jones's War on Terror, Founding Python, Seriously Funny Ruminations on the Post 9/11 War World. Is that, you know, this is a group of guys that were always, you know, mocking religion.
Yes.
You know, and they did it better than anybody. You know, Life of Brian, I mean, not better than anybody, but Life of Brian as a film and as a sort of general question as to the, you know, the reality of Christianity and the story of Christ is hilarious.
Well, you know, they took some heat, too, for some of the religious positions. You know, the whole Spanish Inquisition skit they did was controversial at the time they did it.
That's true. We'll ask him about some of that and also about his new book and his new column. After this, with Terry Jones, it's 27 past the hour.
This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, I am Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
You're listening to Morning's Edition. Ramon was just here. He's got his pants down to his ankles. His underwear is hanging out. He's got his hat turned backwards into the side. What's happened? What's happened now?
Does he have hygiene
issues? Is this rapper Ramon? I don't understand what that's about.
Well, you know, he has to adopt a different persona necessary to navigate the quagmire.
And then he hands me Armstrong Williams as Palm Pilot. Now, Armstrong Williams, obviously not a member of the cabinet, but somebody clearly willing to do the bidding of the RNC.
Private dancer.
Here's his Palm Pilot for today. 7 a.m. Wake up. Zippity-doo-dah.
Oh, my,
what a wonderful day.
Oh, this is going straight to the tanks here.
7:30 a.m. 7:30 a.m. Breakfast. Good morning, Aunt Jemima.
Oh,
my special lady. Here we go. 8 a.m., take car service to work. Tell driver to avoid Martin Luther King Boulevard. 10 a.m., on NPR, defend Bush's handling of the war in Iraq. 4 minutes. Bill RNC, $5,000. 11 a.m., in elevator, casually mention enthusiasm for Bush's Social Security policy. 2 minutes. Bill RNC, $3,000. 1 p.m., lecture to black journalism students. Title, Get Paid by Any Means Necessary. 3 p.m. Watch BET. Note, these people have such interesting slang. 9 p.m. Order Chinese food. Extol the virtues of tort reform to delivery guy. Bill RNC, $200.
Zippity doo dah, okay. Aunt Jemima. Boy, this is going to be a wonderful day here.
Oh, man. Okay, here we go. Now, I'm excited because, you know, I grew up watching, you know, Monty Python, the show, you know, late at night on PBS when it ran when I was a kid. And Terry Jones is one of the original Pythons. He's got a book out. It's Terry Jones's War on Terror, a founding Python, seriously funny ruminations on the post 9/11 world. That's available at our website. He writes columns targeting the Anglo-American response to September 11, 2001. He has a weekly column, I believe. And he also, of course, has been in the Monty Python and the Holy Grail and the Meaning of Life and the Life of Brian, which he also directed. It's I'm thrilled to have you here. Good morning, Terry Jones.
Hi, Mark.
How you doing, Terry?
Very good.
So in your new column, I guess this is dated January 11th, you talk about how you are really bewildered by the world's response to the tsunami tragedy in terms of the amount of money that people are willing to divvy up to help out, and you have a very specific reason for that.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I'm not complaining. I think it's wonderful
people
are divvying out all this money to help the victims of the tsunami. It's just what occurred to me was that it's something like 150,000 people have died in the tsunami wave, whereas 150,000 Iraqis have died in Iraq because of what UK and US have done there.
Mm-hmm.
They've died from bombing and strafing and all that kind of stuff. It's probably around 150,000. But the Lancet article said there was 100,000 at least.
Right.
It's the same amount of human. It's a human catastrophe on the same scale as the tsunami disaster.
Yes.
And yet nobody's sort of raising money to help the dead Iraqis.
I think that they've decided that the killing hasn't stopped yet, and they want to get the numbers right.
They want to get the numbers right. You're probably absolutely right.
But Terry, you know, the thing is, don't the Bush administration and the Blair administration have a vested interest in keeping more or less secret from their various publics, you know, the numbers of people who have actually died? I mean, we don't really, other than this Bloomberg School of Public Health study from Johns Hopkins, there's been no hard and fast estimate. Don't you think that's deliberate?
Well, I think it is. I mean, it's deliberate that they're not doing body counts. So, you know, for one of the first times, nobody's recording how many victims or how many people die. And in fact, as far as we understand, the American military and the British military too, probably for a while there, are actually when they went into Fallujah for the second time, they were actually taking steps to actually stop people counting the bodies. For example, they were attacking clerics and doctors and wiping up hospitals, because it's in the hospitals where they do the body counts, of course. So they were actually actively taking action to stop anybody counting the bodies.
So what kind of reaction are you getting with your columns over there? Are people doing the standard thing they do with people who have a reputation for being funny, just saying like, oh, that's not very witty?
Well, I don't know. I sort of get different reactions, really. I mean, sometimes there was one column I did which sort of became the thing everybody was sending on their internet thing. It was the thing about my neighbors and not liking my neighbors and sort of doing exactly the same reactions that Bush and Blair are doing in world politics and applying that to the politics of the street. And it just suddenly looks ridiculous. You know, if you've got suspicions about, you don't really know. You don't like the way he's looking at you.
Terry, I was just over in England for 2 weeks and got back just after New Year's, and one of the things that struck me was what I perceived to be a simmering anti-Americanism among many of the people that I talked to over there, including members of my wife's own family, for that
matter.
How widespread is that, or is that just an anecdote?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I hope it's not anti-Americanism. I think there's a lot of anti-Bushism and a lot of the present American regime. But I hope it's not being confused with anti-Americanism.
Are you saying that you like us, Terry?
Yeah.
Oh, I think you're lovely.
Oh, okay.
For you, Mark. I'm not sure about the other Mark. Mark, you're wonderful.
Thank you.
Gee, thanks. I'm surprised you were able to parse that quick. Terry, George W. Bush, despite the war in Iraq, won re-election here. Blair is up this year, right, in May?
It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
What do you think is going to happen? Again, talking to people, I got a sense that they had problems with him, but they were resigned to the fact he'd get re-elected because his opposition is so fragmented.
I mean, there's no opposition. I don't know. Who do you vote for? I mean, really? really. There's no one to vote for here. I mean, it's, you know, democracy becomes a joke when you don't have anyone to vote for. What's the point of having democracy? You know, there's no difference. Blair has become more Thatcher than Thatcher. And
really?
They spent all this time, the Labour Party spent all this time stopping what they called entryism when they thought the left wing was taking over the Labour Party. I thought the Labour Party was a left wing party, but anyway. now it's been taken over by, you know, a covert Thatcher supporter, basically.
I just love the fact that in Parliament, when I watch it on television here on C-SPAN or whenever I see it, I like that there's actually debate and yelling and people booing and stuff. That's tremendous. Everyone's afraid to talk in our Senate.
Yeah, right? They try to be courtly. Terry, I don't want to do too much inside stuff here, but how bad is this rift between Blair and his Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown?
I don't really know. I mean, the papers are making a lot of noise about it, but I haven't any idea really about what's going on there. I mean, although Brown was supposed to always be sort of the heir in waiting to take over the throne kind of thing. But I mean, Blair looks so ill. I mean, I can't imagine. He must be racked with guilt. I mean, I can't imagine anybody being able to carry on knowing what he's responsible for, you know? That he's put his country, he's put England on the front line for terrorist attack. By you know, he says he's saving us from terrorism. Of course, they're doing absolutely the opposite thing. I mean, I think that's really why I started writing the columns, because it seemed to me that after 9/11, our great leaders, every single action they took seemed to be designed to have the opposite effect from the one that they said they were going to do.
Well, they wanted to design a new sort of a pseudo-Cold War situation where the element of fear would be spread throughout the world and they can control the people better.
Well, I think that's probably true. I mean, I don't know whether your listeners know about the project for the new American century.
Of course. You know what, Terry? Can we hold you a few more minutes over the break? We hear you're sitting with somebody that might want to pipe in. So we'll talk a little bit about the book and continue this conversation with Terry Jones, one of the founding members of Monty Python. After this, it's 42 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
It's just a wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about this before.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour. We're back. It's a morning sedition with Mark Riley and Mark Maron. You're listening to Air America Radio on the phone. One of the founding members of Monty Python, Terry Jones, also the author of Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, a founding Python seriously funny ruminations on the post 9/11 world. That's available at morningsedition.com for a slight discount. Terry, we were talking about Tony Blair looking awfully exhausted and drained, and because of maybe perhaps he's consumed by guilt. Maybe he's not using his religion properly. Our president seems to have no conscience whatsoever because he's so entrenched in Christianity.
No, I think that's right. I think Bush is actually a perfect front for the people behind him, for the Rumsfelds and Cheneys and Pearls, because he absolutely believes in what he's doing, and he's probably a very nice chap, you know. it's just this thing about them doing exactly the wrong thing. I mean, for example, after 9/11, I thought George Bush said exactly the right thing. He said, "We've got to find the evil perpetrators of this evil crime." Absolutely right. Except that I would have thought if you're going to catch some evil perpetrators of evil crimes, you need secrecy, you need speed, and you need to get them by taken by surprise. What you don't do is announce where you're going to look for them. "We're going to look in Afghanistan." You say, "When are you going to do it?" "We're going to do it in 2 months' time." "You know, that 2 months' time." And then you say, "What are you going to do to them?" "We're going to bomb you." Right? I mean, by that time, any evil perpetrators would have got out of Afghanistan. I would have done. I mean it's so nonsensical. And as a result, have they caught any of the evil perpetrators? No, of course they haven't.
Well, they say they have some of the top of what they think to be Al-Qaeda people locked up.
Yeah.
But now, do you know that today they announced that it's the official end of the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? I guess they really couldn't figure out a way to plant them.
But, I mean, if you were running a firm, an industrial firm or something, and you made mistakes like that, saying they've got weapons of mass destruction, or there's a link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, and you made mistakes on such a scale and committed your company to spending money to do that, you'd be out of a job by now.
Yes.
But here it is, they've spent billions billions and billions of dollars, killed hundreds of thousands of people, and they're still running the show. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, they've made a lot of their friends very, very wealthy.
I think that's what
even
happened,
more so.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
Let me ask you a question about how you approached, you know, the topic of religion with the Monty Python group and specifically in the life of Brian, because, you know, the amazing success of The Passion of Christ was sort of daunting. And yes. I just thought a great double feature would be Life of Brian in The Passion of Christ.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Well,
I mean, when you approach religion, what do you see is sort of, what do you think is the most dangerous about the way religion is being used in the world today?
Well, I think it's the same way it's always been used, quite honestly. I mean, religion has always been a cover for people using, wielding power. And that goes right back to biblical times. It was true in the 14th century. I've got another book that's coming out in the States this week called Who Murdered Chaucer? And that's exactly the same thing when you see how the Archbishop of Canterbury uses his religion to actually support the usurper, Henry IV, who illegally usurps throne of Richard II. And it's the same, that people have always used religion as a cover for holding and wielding power. I've got another gentleman here just walked into the room, Terry Gilliam.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Would you like a word with him?
Sure.
Yeah, put him on the phone.
Hang on a second.
Okay, all right. Two for one here.
Yeah.
Hello.
How are you doing?
How are you, Terry Gilliam? It's Mark and Mark here.
Hi.
So, you know, are you guys working on something right now? You got a movie in the works, Terry?
Well, I do. Terry's just using my phone at the moment.
What do you got going? Is it going to be something trippy?
Oh, I got it. No, I've got a film I'm just finishing off now called Tideland, which I kind of describe as Alice in Wonderland meets Psycho.
So yes, definitely trippy.
Yeah,
I'm a huge fan of your work, and I recently watched Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and I got to be honest with you, if you did any drugs whatsoever in your life, as I have, it makes perfect sense, Terry.
Oh, great, that's good because I don't do drugs, and I was hoping that there would be people to confirm my ideas were correct.
You definitely got the vibe, and I don't know what you how. You made Benicio del Toro do whatever the hell he did in that movie, but it was really disturbing and very provocative.
Good.
So how long have you been affiliated with the Pythons, and how did that start?
Oh, that's from way back from the beginning. The first connection was somewhere around 1963 in New York when I met John Cleese. He mm-hmm. was in New York with a group called Cambridge Circus, and they were doing a review show in the Village, and I was editing a magazine, and I got him to appear in the magazine in a photo story about a man who falls in love with his daughter's Barbie doll.
Yeah, and the rest is history.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so you moved to England. You lived there primarily.
Yeah, I mean, I left the States in '67 and have been here ever since.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
What attracted you?
Well, it was a combination of, you know, English humor, the fact that I was living with an English girlfriend, and I became very disillusioned with America in '67 and felt either I'm going to start becoming a full-time radical and a bomb-throwing radical, or I could be a, you know, reasonably happy cartoonist.
That's interesting. Either I destroy the state or make funny things.
That's right.
There you go.
Of dealing with it. There's many ways of attacking the state.
Absolutely.
One of these provides more entertainment for other people.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to us. Is Terry sitting there going, it's my interview. It's mine. Okay. Can I have the phone, please?
Yes, he wants to tell you everything.
There you go.
Well, nice talking to you, Terry.
Thanks, Terry.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi there.
Hey, sir.
Were you getting mad?
Now, this is Terry Jones. For the audience that's just tuning in, this is Terry Jones we're talking to now. We just got finished talking to Terry Gilliam.
Is Terry Gilliam sitting there? What? You said you gave me the phone.
I just walked into that. I'm actually just doing a commentary on a Preston Sturges film, Sullivan's Travels, in about 10 minutes. Right?
Oh, really?
I came to Goldcrest, and they said, oh, Terry Gilliam's upstairs. So I didn't even realize he was here.
You know, I read this article about you guys, the remaining Pythons were discussing, Eric Idle's new musical. And there's an article in New York Magazine, I think.
Oh, yeah, New Yorker, yeah.
The New New Yorker about how, and it also, like, it's just like, well, I, you know, I called everyone. We had a conference call. You organized a conference call, and everyone said, well, sounds good. And I thought to myself, I would just like to hear you guys just talking seriously on the phone at the same time. It was unlike any show business story I'd ever read before, where there's usually cutthroat battles, but you guys are all friends, huh?
Yeah, I guess we are, actually. I mean, Terry's let me use his office, so you can't.
Do you guys ever get, I mean, I guess maybe it's past the point where you guys got sick and tired of always being referred to in the context of Python, huh?
Yeah, that doesn't worry me too much. I mean, it's just because it's just like a short circuit. You know, you can actually, you don't have to explain who you are, so that's quite nice. And there are a lot of Terry Joneses around, I have to say.
So Michael Palin's just become a world traveler, huh?
Yes. He's difficult to get a hold of. I mean, and he lived just down the road, actually. So Terry Gilliam and Mike are very close.
Do you ever get calls from him just saying, I'm in the Himalayas?
I can only say he's never phoned me from the Himalayas.
We got a fax coming in here from the Barbra Streisand compound. So hang on a second. This is our liberal agenda for today, Terry.
Okay,
here are your marching orders. One, only 5 guilt-cultivating days until Martin Luther King's birthday. 2, combat any lingering happiness by seeing Million Dollar Baby and Hotel Rwanda back-to-back.
Oh, God.
3, complain to news channels covering tsunami recovery that the name the Indian Ocean really should be the Native American Ocean. 4, write defend privacy rights on your buttocks, go to the lobby of the nearest federal building and moon security cameras. Thank you for your courage, Randy Moss. 5, quote of the day, just drop it into conversation. Oh, great. The new Homeland Security chief was lead counsel for part of the Whitewater investigation. I guess now we won't have to worry about terrorists putting up crappy condos, man. Wake up, sheeple. Terry Jones, thank you for joining us. It was great talking to you. The book is Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, a founding Python seriously funny ruminations on the post 9/11 world. We'll push the book for you, Terry. It's available on our website at morningsedition.com. Have a good day.
Take care. Thanks, love.
Okay, take care. That was wild.
That was wild.
Terry Gilliam's just hanging out.
Well, I wasn't. Terry Jones was using his office? Is that what it was?
It's just like the whole idea. It's like, yeah, they want to talk to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Hey, come on down.
It's weird. I was a fan of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. A lot of people didn't like that movie, and it is a weird movie. And if you read the book and you got the groove of the book, I thought, you know, I don't know why I'm just plugging this movie for no reason, but I thought Johnny Depp was a fascinating caricature of Hunter S. Thompson. I'm not looking forward to Willy Wonka, though.
See, I used to read Hunter Thompson's columns in Rolling Stone.
Funny.
Eons ago.
Yeah.
He's a funny
dude.
Yeah, he's a very, very funny dude. He just cut down on the wild turkey a little bit.
He's a little whacked now. But, man, I'm telling you, when that guy hit it, man, he hit it.
He had
a real poetry to him. You know, he had a real succinct way of describing things. You know, even just in the subheading of The Generation of Swine, which is his writing from the 80s, he just said, the pigs are out of the tunnel. Enough with the pigs are out of the tunnel.
There you go. Now, coming up, Paul Krugman. Talking Social Security when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron, you're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, self-designated leaders of the collective we. How are you this morning? How is the we? Of course, I want to say hi to all the progressive utopians with no sense of humor who do nothing but criticize and will never be happy. How are you this morning? I hope you're having a nice cup of coffee. Riley's sitting there obsessed with his biceps today. This is the second time with the biceps.
It's a thing now.
Is it because you're wearing a short sleeve shirt and you've become aware that you're...
No, it's just every now and then you have to touch yourself. No, no,
don't. Yeah. Ooh. So I got to... It's a big 7 o'clock hour.
Yeah.
A couple of things happened out there in the world. Of course, California is slowly falling into the sea. My wife's out there. My house is out there, but I think everything's okay.
And they're both okay, right?
Yeah, I feel very bad for the people that have, you know, in this big mess all around the world. It seems that the weather is... you know, taking, it's bad, man. It's bad. I kind of was hoping for a little snow, though.
You know, it's starting to make me nervous, man, that sooner or later people are going to tie all of these different weather cataclysms together and say it's time to, you know, gather in one place and wait for the
Oh, no, that happens. I think that happens in small groups almost every day in this country. Somewhere someone's saying, you guys, this is it.
Yeah.
This is the signs of the end times. We're going to get in my basement. I've got some beans and some other stuff. I think if you just, you know, bring your canned goods, we should be okay for a little while.
Or maybe go to the top of a mountain in the Pathfinder and just wait for the Lord to take you away.
Yeah. What I'm not hearing enough of, though, is the secret satellite that was put up there as a strategic defense satellite that's actually some sort of, you know, combination of, you know, Wilhelm Reich's Orgone, you know, cloud buster and some sort of strange digital technology that they're actually using to create all these disasters to distract us from their slow but sure plan to overtake the world.
Well, you didn't know that we're broadcasting on a frequency generated by that same satellite.
Oh, man. We're part of the badness?
Well, I don't know. We try to do good while we broadcast on bad. What
apparently, the hunt for biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons in Iraq has come to an end.
Yes, over.
The reason that we went there was a sham. They have nothing to show for it.
Wait. Are you saying they didn't find anything?
They didn't find nothing.
Are you sure?
They revisited some of those videos of people looking for weapons of mass destruction. I love seeing that on CNN. You just see a
file footage.
You just see a guy, you know, with a stick, you know, Marine with a stick pulling a dirty rag out of a bucket. Like,
yeah.
Is this it?
You know, right?
You see, like, they just walk into these places that look like sheds that have, like, you know, one rusted can of something. Is this it?
They look like those guys that, you know, comb the beaches for metal objects with that divining rod or something.
Clearly, there was nothing there. It was a sham. They knew there was nothing there, and now there's, like, you know, upwards of 1,300 dead American soldiers, 6,000 to 10,000 soldiers injured, possibly 100,000 dead Iraqis, and the reason that they told us they went was a lie.
Yes, an out-and-out, straight-up lie.
And now this lie has just faded into history. Today marks that day. The hunt for biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons in Iraq has come to an end, which on some level, the only thing I'm happy about is that they didn't plant any.
Somewhere, Hans Blix, who's been on our show, is smiling. He is smiling.
Knew it all the time.
Yep.
Knew it all the time. You know who I met the other day, Mark Riley?
Who?
I was at the small, strange Chinese practitioner's office and workout area where I go work out with my guy who I've worked out with for years, this guy Ari Weller.
Okay.
Great trainer. He brings it all together, man. Gyrotonics. He brings the yoga in. He brings the Pilates in. You know what I mean?
Really?
I'm not trying to be buff. I'm just trying to make sure my body doesn't crumple.
You want to be able to put your kneecap over your shoulder, is what you're
saying?
Well,
no. I just want to not to. I don't want to crumple pre crumple time. You know what I mean? Because I don't know if I'm going to have Social Security.
Oh yeah. We're gonna be talking about that with somebody who knows what the deal is.
Well, I'm definitely gonna have. I hope so. I hope they don't lose it all on 7. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, guy, can I get some of my retirement money? Because my body is crumpling and decaying.
Yeah.
We'll see if you get some of that retirement money. Come on, Red!
Ooh,
00. Nothing pays.
Well, you know, the scary thing about that, Mark, is that, you know, you could be 23 years old. Because remember that Bush is aiming this whole privatization push on kids, on younger people in the workforce. All right, you're 25 years old. Looks good, Bush's proposal, right? So you go ahead, you invest a certain amount of your money in that, and let's say you make out like a bandit. So by the time you're 30, you've got like maybe 40% more than you put in.
Yeah.
But then by the time you're 62, you've got 40% less.
Yeah, after three or four market cycles,
you know,
up and down, who the hell knows what happens to it?
Exactly. Who the hell knows?
And I'm telling you, I don't care if he's talking to kids. You know what I mean? And when I was a kid, I didn't register. But let me get back to who I met. So I'm at the gym. I'm twisting into some sort of stupid position in order to do a stretch exercise that involves a downward dog, and then you kind of roll over and do another one. Robin Quivers.
Robin Quivers is the one that married Mike Tyson.
Oh, I did it again. Oh, man.
We can hyphenate it. Robin Quivens.
Robin Quivers came in, and she's sitting there, and my trainer knows her, and she sees the doctor who's there, and I talk to her, you know. It's weird when you talk to her, because, you know, it's like, wow.
She's a normal person.
Well, she's a normal person, but she is Robin Quivers, and you feel like, and now I'm on radio, too, so it was almost a matter of like, well, this must be what Howard feels like. I was just like, hey, how you doing? She's like, how are you? And I'm like, well, this is what, but, I asked her about the hours. I said, do you ever get used to them? And she said, no, you never do. And I'm like, great.
Thanks for the support.
I said, yeah, I do a show. She knew I did the morning show over here on Air America. And I actually said, I'm sorry I don't get to listen to your show. But what kind of thing is that to say? Like, you know, you're on what network? You have a co-host, right? It's you and, no, but I mean, I said, and she goes, really? I don't get to listen to yours either. But she was very nice, and she seemed very grounded and well.
You know, see that that
I told her I worked with you, thinking that she would know you.
Oh no, she don't know.
Been around for years.
No, no, no.
She didn't know you.
No, we travel in different circles.
She might know you. I don't know. She went on.
Well, look, it's amazing to me that two morning radio hosts,
yeah,
both go to the same place for the same reason. I assume she went for the same reason as you.
She actually went to see Dr. Lee. I think she had some sort of problem. She didn't go to train there. It's not really a training thing. I don't know how it works in the particular kung fu realm. You know, the Dr. Lee is a master, and he's also a practitioner of Chinese medicine. And his adept, his protege or whatever, protege, I don't know what they call him, he kind of runs the place. So they rent out to massage people, they rent out to a few trainers who do a certain type of training, and he also does Chinese medicine there. So it's sort of this, you know.
But it's all symbiotic. There's a synergy in terms of the training.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, kind of. The type of people that are involved there. Yeah. But she was there to see the doctor, and I got to see another doctor tomorrow. This is my dream diary from last night. All right. So I'm at work, and, also before I do this, keep the music going. We're going to be taking calls after this, 866-303-2270, for you to share your dreams with us, and we're going to try and interpret them. How would that be?
Yeah.
Reach out, and don't think about it too much. Try and give us some real dreams. We had one yesterday that scared some
like me.
Scared some older people in the office. Not older people, but
hey, I look younger. You told me that.
Freaked me out. Yeah, no, your haircut makes you look younger. Here's my dream daughter from last night. So I'm at work, and Armstrong Williams is there. And he says to me, you got to get into endorsements, Mark. That's where the real money is. And then he looks deep into my eyes, taps my forehead three times, and leaves. I feel a little dizzy, and my eyes start to water. But I go into the show anyways. Good morning. I'm Mark Maron, and this is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, which is carried on both XM and Sirius Satellite Radio. So I got up this morning with my Braun Travel Alarm Clock, and I took a shower using Dr. Bronner's peppermint soap and washed and conditioned my hair with Wella Wellness Life Tech's Wake Up Call Hydrating Shampoo and Big Splash Hydrating Conditioner. Then I brushed my teeth with my Sonicare toothbrush and cool, refreshing Crest toothpaste. And I lotioned up with some Kiehl's products. Then I had a bowl of delicious Barber's Puffins with Westoy Vanilla soy milk, and a cup of rich, satisfying, chock-full of nuts coffee. Then I put on my 100% pure wool Banana Republic sweater, my olive green Levi's 505 corduroys, and my rugged and stylish Clark's desert boots.
Ooh.
I put on my black Donna Karen overcoat and was driven to work in a luxurious Lincoln Town Car. Boy, that's a stretch. 2 years old, but you're luxurious. When I got to work, I logged on to the always provocative salon.com on my state-of-the-art Dell Inspiron 1100 laptop computer. Hey, Kalo, was that the hot new recording artist Franz Ferdinand on Domino Records? I thought so. I got that CD at the Virgin Megastore in Times Square, right? I also find the best selection and prices on DVDs, books, clothing, and so much more. That song reminds me of that fantastic new movie now playing at the theater near you, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, starring Bill Murray, Owen Wilson, and Cate Blanchett from Touchstone Pictures, that I saw over the weekend, right after my wife and I had a spectacular meal at the Neptune Diner, 3105 Astoria Boulevard in Astoria, New York. Let's take a call using reliable, crystal clear telephone service from Verizon. I woke up and my bed was filled with copies of The Jerusalem Syndrome, available at morningsedition.com. If you've got a dream that you want to share,
hey,
you
please,
feel,
don't try to top what he just did, okay?
Yeah,
call us, but don't try to. Don't go there, all right?
We can be candid and you can be honest.
Yeah.
866-303-2270 is our number. We'll be back with Dream Interpretation here on Morning Sedition, 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 21 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're taking calls with dreams. 866-303-2270. These aren't the kind of dreams that, you know, things you want to do.
Yeah, not those kind of dreams, all right?
These are the real dreams that creep up into you, into your head in the night. Here we go. Let's take our first call. Tricia in San Diego. What's going on?
Hi, Tricia.
Hello. I turned off my radio like, you know, you do when you call NPR because I think there's like a delay. So.
Oh, no. Okay, oh, okay, good.
Okay, so anyway, so do I tell my dream now?
Sure, yeah. Please.
Okay. I was with my boyfriend who's younger than I am.
Okay.
And his friend.
And his boyfriend? Did you?
And I'm sorry,
yeah, no. You just had a slip.
This is a strange dream we got.
So we're in line for the San Diego Zoo, and it's like really long, and so we're waiting and waiting, and then we get to the front of the line, and my boyfriend's asleep. He's like on the sidewalk asleep, and so I look at the girl on the counter, and I'm like, okay, hang on, let me wake up my boyfriend. He just wants to go.
Uh-huh.
And I felt like during the whole thing, like I had to take care of him, because I think because he's younger than I am,
yeah,
like I was babysitting the two kids kind of thing.
Wow.
I know.
So I'm not, this wasn't a dream about voting, was it?
No, but we met at like the whole Kucinich thing. That's how left we are.
Okay, whoa, okay.
So, yeah, so, but yeah, because like we had gone out for New Year's, the three of us, and
yeah,
there's this like Buddhist bell ringing thing on Shelter Island.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's like, I don't know, I feel like whenever all three of us get together, I'm like the mom, which
yeah,
is really not probably good, because they should probably look for more responsible parents.
I can interpret this.
They should probably look for a more responsible parent. What about maybe a more age-appropriate boyfriend? How old is he?
He's 24 and I'm 32.
Oh, that's fine.
That's not that bad. That's, but you know what?
It's cool. It's
that's
good.
Perfect. Look, listen to you. Of course it's good.
Good. Of course it's good. I'm having a ball over here. But you know what? I get a sense, Tricia, that maybe you're having like a Laura Bush sort of thing. She takes care of twins, or did for
a while. Oh, quiet down. Oh, that's horrible.
Quiet down.
Oh, my God. Laura Bush.
No, I think what you're, in my limited knowledge of dream interpretation, I think what you had was there's a little bit of disappointment that you know, the election didn't work out the way it was because, you know, people were waiting online so long, but because it was a zoo, you know, I think there might be a certain amount of fear involved in going into the zoo. So your boyfriend got so exhausted just thinking that he'd have to see something wild that he fell asleep in the line.
Oh.
And then maybe you just felt like I think maybe it has to do with, hey, maybe it's a fear of a commitment thing.
Oh, I'm sure of that.
Because you're like ready to go to the zoo. You're ready to take the next step. You're ready to go into the mysteries of the wild.
No, I think I'm like running away from that.
Well, okay, so
you're the one running away.
Well, here, we can just tweak it then. You want to run away into the zoo, into the wild lands of freedom I guess it's not really freedom because it's a zoo. I'm just riffing.
But wait a minute, Tricia, what about this third guy? How often are you out for dreams?
Oh, my gosh. You know, like I was just telling your caller, I was like, you know, that could be like a whole other thing because, like, I don't know, like, my boyfriend's a stable one, and his friend and I are both, like, totally nuts. I mean, and speaking of nuts,
yeah,
I'm trying to get tickets to your show, Mark.
Yeah.
In Poway.
Okay.
And, because, like, you're nuts, I can tell.
Okay. Okay, dude, listen to this, though. Let me, before you get into that, look, I just looked up zoo on this dream dictionary. To
right,
dream that you're at a zoo symbolizes loss of freedom and your abilities and talents go unnoticed. You are an aspect of your life, and an aspect of your life feels caged in. The zoo may also represent chaos and confusion, as implied by the common phrase, this place is a zoo. You may need to tidy up some situation in your life.
Oh, that's totally true. That's totally true. See, look at your site. You're like Dr. Laura.
Well, I know. I wish I made it up.
Gee.
I just freaked out and went online. So what about my show in Poway? What happened?
So I was on my computer last night trying to get tickets.
Yeah.
And their computer thing is screwed up because there was, like, going through and it's, like, pick the seats and then find now and blah, 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 blah.
Uh-huh.
And then just kept looping through. So they need to get it together. But I'm going to try to call them tomorrow to get tickets because I'd like to see that.
Oh, I'd like you to come. I got to call them, too.
Yeah, get on them.
All right,
I'm saying it on radio. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for calling us.
Thanks, Tricia.
It was nice talking to you, Tricia. Well, that was interesting. Quickly, we've got to do one more and we don't have that much time. So let's try this. Melanie in Boston.
Melanie.
Hello?
What's your dream, Melanie?
Well, I'm moving in with my two friends. They're a couple, and her boyfriend was making advances to me naked, taking you know, his pants off in my dream last night.
Are you sure you weren't drunk and it was really happening?
That's a good one. No.
I'm sorry.
No, I really, I would, the thing is I'm, I would rather, you know, even if I was in love with him, I still would rather be the person that preserves her friend's, you know, feelings. And
well, this dream's pretty clear. You're nervous about the situation. Either you have feelings for him or you think he has feelings for you, and it might ruin your friendship.
Yep.
Okay, thank you for calling. That was very interesting. I guess we got to go in a minute. Is that what we're doing
here? We
got Paul Krugman coming up.
Oh yeah,
that's going to be good.
We're going to debunk all of this mythology about Social Security and answer the questions. The question: are the Democrats ready to cave on this thing? Because they're making noises like, well, you know, there is a problem, but we got plenty of time to fix it, and that's just what Bush wants.
And Krugman is, you know, he's on top of this. He's like, in his recent column, he says about privatization, the budget deficit might well exceed 8% of the GDP at some time during the next decade. That's a deficit that could make Carlos Menem's Argentina look like a model of responsibility.
Yeah.
So, always looking forward to talking to Krugman.
He's a great guy.
He'll be here. Thanks for your dreams. I love those segments, I have to tell you. I love that kind of stuff.
It's interesting dream stuff.
I just love talking to people. All right, we'll be back in a minute on Air America Radio. I did it again, Riley. 34 past the hour. I didn't time my mouth full of Rice Krispie treats properly.
Rice Krispie treats?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're going to have to make another trip back to the gym.
This is morning's edition. Are they that bad?
No.
There's some part of me that's like, it's just marshmallows and cereal. How can that be bad? Anyways, look, you know what I mean? This is important.
Yeah.
I'm very excited to have our next guest. This is morning's edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. You're listening to Air America Radio. Our next guest is... His column appears every Tuesday and Friday in the New York Times. He's also a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University. His latest book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century, is out now in paperback. You can get that on our website at morningsedition.com. He is Paul Krugman. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Paul.
I'm very happy to have you here because I guess following your lead on some level and just following what's going on in the news, Social Security is going to be the primary issue that needs to be addressed for the next how long?
next few months, we think, anyway.
And what do you think is going to initially going to happen here? I mean, his tactics are, can we just play a soundbite for you to start this off? Let's hear that, Chris.
There's a problem. I happen to believe people who've been elected to office who ignore problems will face a price at the ballot box.
This was Bush speaking yesterday, and I guess he is basically threatening Congress, yes?
Yeah, they're going to try the thing that has worked so many times before, which is create an overwhelming sense that, you know, if you don't do it his way, you're... if we don't demolish Social Security, the terrorists have won. So there we go.
Okay, and what do you think? Is there a possibility? I mean, it seems to me that a lot of Republicans, it's become clear that, you know, and it was clear from the beginning, but there is no real mandate. And these guys, some of these Republicans and conservatives, are free to go against the president now, yes?
Well, Republican Party has, you know, you have relatives in red states. They have a lot of arm twisting possible. So I don't think it's ever a good idea to assume that just because this is a lousy idea, and a lot of Republicans know it's a lousy idea, that it won't pass. There have actually been some Republican congressmen who said, you know, I think this is a lousy idea, but, you know, the president, we can't impair his authority because he has to fight terror, so we need to vote for Social Security demolition. So it actually is I'm only partly joking there. They're certainly having a harder time than they expected.
Right.
Now, Paul, I've read some stuff from some Democratic operatives and Democrats on the Hill that have kind of ceded to Bush the idea that, yes, Social Security does, in fact, have to be fixed. They seem to be disagreeing with the president about how to fix it. And my sense is that is not an argument that's going to work, that you really do have to say to the American people that that this is the first step toward eliminating the program, the nation's most successful social service program.
Yeah, I think the Democrats need to say, look, sure, it's possible, though not certain, that Social Security has some long-run financial shortfall and we should strengthen it. And we'll do that with a couple of things like adjusting the way the payroll tax is collected and so on. But that I think they really need to hammer on the idea that the program is a very successful program. It's in pretty good shape. It's in a lot better financial shape than the rest of the federal government, actually. And that, in any case, the what these guys are proposing to do doesn't address any of the supposed problems and is in fact a scheme to dismantle the thing.
Paul, I'm curious. I remember in 2000 when Al Gore and George W. Bush were going back and forth about Social Security, and they all were talking about putting the trust fund essentially in a lockbox and not not using it to deal with whatever government programs or whatever that they needed it for. Has that happened, or has the government, in fact, gone into the trust fund for things other than paying out benefits?
Well, the right way to say it is that the government, you know, think of the government as two pieces. There's Social Security, and there's the other stuff, and those are very different, and they're supported by different taxes. And the other part of the government has run these huge deficits, and it's borrowed a lot of the money to cover those deficits from the Social Security system. And the whole lockbox thing was saying, you know, don't do that because the Social Security will eventually need to be repaid on those debts, and so you need to run a responsible budget in the rest of the government.
How much does the government owe the trust fund now?
$1.8 trillion.
$1.8 trillion.
Yeah.
What they spend it on? I didn't get any.
Well, yeah. If your income was over $300,000 a year, you got it in the form of tax cuts.
So you're saying that on some level, the government now, you know, yeah, you have to bear with me because I'm mentally challenged when it comes to economics. The government on some level is already in the process of bankrupting Social Security from their end.
No, the government is in the process of bankrupting itself.
Okay.
And that's a problem for all of its creditors.
And now is that
a system? But you don't want to single out Social Security as a particularly. I mean, if the government is really in danger of not being able to pay its debts, then Social Security is in trouble. But so are Japanese pension funds. So is the Reserve Bank of China. All of these people who've bought U.S. bonds.
Is that part of the plan, Paul? Is it part of the plan on behalf of some of these neoconservative whack jobs to actually bankrupt the government, which would force us into a privatization situation with almost everything?
Well, you know, wait a second. They certainly the plan is to starve the beast.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't enough revenue, so you have to get rid of all these nasty social programs like Medicare. I think the important thing to say is that if we're going to have I don't think they're planning on having a fiscal crisis. They haven't sort of figured that out, where you just can't pay the bills. But if we do have one, Social Security is going to be the least of it. And the really important thing to say in all of this, by the way, is that privatization does nothing.
Right.
To solve these issues. I mean, this is the amazing thing. If they say, oh, look, the baby boomers are going to retire and we're going to have to pay these benefits, we can't do that, so we're going to have to privatize Social Security. Then you ask, well, what does privatization actually do to the government budget deficit? You know, when do we actually start to see some savings, even if everything goes well, which it won't, but even if everything goes well? The answer, according to the Congressional Budget Office, is 2050. Mm-hmm. So by the time you actually start to save any money from privatization, the youngest surviving baby boomers will be 86 years old.
Right. Now, let me just get something clear up, because this is not what you would call a standard model of privatization. I mean, it seems to me that the plan they want to put in place is really more like gambling.
Yeah.
It will make certain elements of Wall Street, rich. But, you know, in privatizing things, that sort of makes certain companies and corporations rich. Like they tried to privatize energy, right, with Enron, and they tried to have them dictate energy policy. Now they're going to try and have Wall Street dictate Social Security policy. But that seems more like gambling to me.
Well, yeah, actually, you know, we don't have to talk in the abstract here.
Okay.
It turns out that the British, under Margaret Thatcher, did something which is pretty close in the important respects to what these guys want to do, to what the Bushies want to do.
Okay.
There's an article about it. I've written about it a little bit in the Times, but there's much more by the pensions correspondent from the Financial Times. She's got an article in the American Prospect. Prospect.org, if anybody wants to go there, and it's a description of how it's worked out in Britain, and the title says it all, A Bloody Mess,
Okay.
Wow.
It's been a total disaster, but very profitable for some investment companies.
Paul Krugman, how does the Bush administration plan to reconcile the cost of their privatization plan, which is estimated anywhere from $1 to $2 trillion, with apparent, you know, noises coming out of the administration now that he's going to have an extremely tight budget proposal? Where is all of this going to come? Where's the money going
to
come from?
I tell you, that $1 to $2 trillion, that's the first decade, and this plan actually is going to call for borrowing for 45 years. So the actual cost over the 45 years is $15 trillion. You gotta.
Whoa.
They're really selling it, you know. And everybody in the media is bought into the, oh well, it's only the first decade, but actually it goes on. It, like I said, doesn't. You keep on borrowing for this plan until 2050.
But these guys,
they until the youngest baby boomers are 85 years old. Yeah. In terms of the. How where's the money going to come from? Well, it's going to be borrowed. You say, well, how are they? You know, what does that do to the budget deficit? And of course, the Bushes have the perfect answer. They're going to say, well, this borrowing doesn't count.
So they don't really care about the future.
I don't. You know,
it's really hard for me to figure out. Well, think about it. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with Paul Krugman after this, and try and see, you know, what Social Security looks like, you know, in their model, and how bad it's going to get, and also, you know, what it looks like if we do the right thing and keep it intact. We'll be back. It's 44 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
It's just the way it goes.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about this before.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Our guest on the phone, New York Times op-ed columnist. His column appears every Tuesday and Friday. He is a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Is available at morningsedition.com or at bookstores or wherever you get your books near you. Paul Krugman is with us. Now, Paul, you mentioned the $2 trillion it's going to take to get this thing going, and as sort of an extended loan of approximately 45 years, right?
Yes. So, it ends up being, again, the number we sold here is $15 trillion.
Right, okay, that's what I wanted to get at. $15 trillion, that seems like a tall order to me. Now, what I want to know also is, now this issue is obviously taking front seat to health care, to insurance, to everything else, and it seems to me that because of the caps on Social Security and what we pay out in Social Security, that this is really going to hurt people. You know, obviously everybody, but the people it's going to hurt the most are people that, you know, that don't have any other retirement plans.
Yeah, think about this whole thing as being this is actually class warfare if you come down to it.
Right.
This is about hurting the bottom 75% of the population so that you can preserve tax cuts for the top 5% of the population.
And he's trying to scare kids. Listen to this soundbite, Paul.
No.
He's trying to scare children with this stuff.
If you're 20 years old and you're mid-20s and you're beginning to work, I want you to think about a Social Security system that will be flat bust, bankrupt, unless the United States Congress has got the willingness to act now.
That's pretty effective, isn't it?
Yeah. I've got that quote sitting in front of me.
Along with
the little fact-checking from the folks at CBS MarketWatch.
Uh-huh.
And they say, you know, the facts, the system cannot go bankrupt. By law, the trustees will continue to pay reduced benefits even if the trust fund is exhausted. And even under a flat-bust system,
yeah,
retirement benefits will be significantly higher than today's benefits in real terms.
So let's talk about in real terms. What you're saying is that if we want to keep the system intact, which we should, it would just basically take maybe over the years an increase in how you do payroll taxes, right?
Yeah.
And also maybe, you know, upping the retirement age a couple of years?
Yeah. The best estimates out there, look, it may not take anything. But you probably want to take a little bit of insurance. I mean, there's a lot of estimates out there that say that the system may well. I think people I talk to say that the odds are better than even, that the system will never need any more money than we've already arranged to give it. But
oh, really?
All right, put a little bit more in. And the Congressional Budget Office says that if you put in really about a fifth of the Bush tax cuts, that's good for the next 75 years.
So what is it with people who actually are placated by these tax cuts that give them maybe a couple hundred extra dollars a year at the risk of them, you know, not having so many social programs that would be helpful to them?
That's right. I mean, the tax cuts are overwhelmingly for people with very high incomes, and the shortfall in Social Security, if there is one, is a small fraction of that, and for anybody really. With an income below $100,000 a year, this is a really terrible bargain.
Mm-hmm. Paul, you know, you say in the column that you wrote yesterday in the Times, The Iceberg Cometh, that you don't think, and you mentioned this to us earlier, that you don't think all will go according to Bush's plan in his plan. And you say you're going to explain why in another column. Well, we don't want to wait for another column, Paul.
First thing I'm going to talk about, probably for Friday, is, well, we got a real experience.
Mm-hmm.
Got a real experience in Britain. And it's eerie how close, even the way that Margaret Thatcher sold privatization of the pensions there. It sounds exactly the same as the way Bush is selling it. And a lot of the details, I mean, there's obviously some differences, but there are a lot of the details are amazingly similar to what Bush is proposing. And it was a bloody disaster. The investment funds, first of all, there was a lot of fraud. A lot of people fell for companies that said, we'll invest your money, we'll get you great rates of return, and then sort of disappeared. Then even the legit, honest companies charged high fees. A lot of people found that a third of their retirement just got eaten up by management fees for their money. Rates of return weren't what people thought. And now the Brits are looking at, at what looks like it's going to be the return of large-scale poverty among older people, which is something that they had pretty much eliminated in the good years. And they're saying, we have to throw a lot of money at this. The official pensions commission said, that people who think that by privatizing the system we actually solved our problems are living in a fool's paradise.
So they have a situation where I wouldn't be surprised if they recommend euthanasia for the elderly eventually.
Well, there have been a bunch of things, you know, along the lines of Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal.
Here. Sure.
Here's what will happen. If we get this thing, for the next 25, 30 years, we're borrowing like crazy, supposedly to solve our problems in the future. And then around 2035, we'll be in the situation that the Brits are in right now. And we'll take a look and we'll say, my God, those private accounts are really doing a lousy job. People are going to be in real trouble. And some future commission will be saying, well, you know, we're going to have to raise taxes or cut benefits to make up for all these losses on the private accounts.
And how long before we hit the Argentinian model?
Well, that actually probably comes a lot sooner. I mean, the truth is, if you look at the... It's really hard to see how we get through the next 15 years with the Bush tax cuts, with the Medicare bill from 2003, which did almost nothing for seniors but is a huge piece of corporate welfare for the drug industry. You put those things together, and, boy, you do the numbers. You just do a straight extrapolation to 2020, and you get a budget deficit number that's just impossible. Can't happen.
I'm glad you didn't make me do that, actually.
Yeah, right. Paul, President Bush yesterday said that politicians who oppose him on this will pay at the ballot box. Yet it appears as though the politicians themselves feel supporting Bush on this could cost them at the ballot box. Who's right?
Well, it depends a lot on how the campaign is run. I mean, you know, never underestimate these guys. Maybe we'll have the Swift Boat Veterans for Social Security privatization or something. if the public gets the thing, understands the issues correctly, it'll be the opposite of what Bush thinks. But, you know, I have to say the media coverage has been, for the most part, really bad. I mean,
really? That's surprising.
It's been really, you know, there have been a lot of things. There have been, you know, panels to where they have two independent experts to discuss the thing, and they get one guy from the Cato Institute and one guy from the Heritage Foundation. Nice balance.
Oh, yeah, that's balance.
That's unbelievable.
It's been very, very hard. I mean, I guess I can say this. People are saying, why don't you go on the Sunday talk shows to talk about what a bad idea this is? And the answer is, guys, I can't get on the Sunday talk shows. They don't want to hear critiques of privatization.
Who specifically? Do you have real incidents?
What?
Yeah,
I just can't get on any of them.
Oh, okay. You did.
What, really?
Now, yeah. let me just talk to you, because we certainly admire you here at the network, and we certainly we're big fans of the column, and I learn things from you all the time. Now, you've chosen this issue. You know, this is your issue, and is there a personal reason that's so important to you? You just think this is the issue that everything hinges on?
Well, it's the thing everything hinges on. It happens to be, you know, in this case, I have some, you know, expertise that most columnists don't have. I mean, I know some things that most of them don't, like arithmetic.
Are you thinking about an early retirement? Is that what's fueling this?
No, I mean this is just something. If you look, if you read the Grand Unraveling, you'll see that actually in the 2000 campaign, it was the Social Security privatization stuff that convinced me way back in the spring of 2000 that George W. Bush was a big liar.
Yes.
And here it is. We've now come full circle, and this is the key issue. And the lies have gotten bigger.
Well, I certainly appreciate what you do, Paul, and I appreciate you being on our show, Paul Krugman. You take care.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
That's his book is available on our website, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Did you notice that I screw up everybody's name at least once?
Yeah.
I said this subconscious prejudice thing is not true.
Well, wait till we get to the next hour when we talk to Stephanie McLuhan. Go ahead, say it.
Stephanie McLuhan.
Ah, there you go. She is, of course, the daughter of one of the leading intellectuals of the 20th century, and she'll be with us when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. And, you know, just everybody, good morning, Mark Riley. It's Wednesday.
Good morning, Mark Maron. Yes, it is.
We're making it through. We're making it through, man. Here, let's do a little business. Oppose Alberto Gonzalez. Contact your senator and learn more about veterans opposing Gonzalez by going to the links page on morningsedition.com. Refuse to surrender your freedom. Sign the ACLU's pledge by going to the links page on morningsedition.com. You can also blog at morningsedition.com or email us at sedition@ameramericaradio.com. And you can help the victims of the tsunami in Asia, Mark Riley, if you go there. I will be at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts, on Friday and Saturday, January 21st and 22nd, going over some stuff.
Yeah.
Doing something. You can go to morningsedition.com for that. It's been a good morning so far.
It's been a great morning so far.
I want to give people a little cat update, because I know some people are hanging by the edge of their beds or wherever they are, wondering about my feral cats. Well, I got to be honest with you. One of them is just turned into this loving little man.
Really?
Yes. Monkey has become a very charming little cat man.
I told you.
Yeah, but the black and white one, Hissy, I don't know. You know, I'm petting her, but it's a very weird thing because they are innately wild. Mark Riley, that is what they believe to be the truth of reality, is that they must always be on the defensive and freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's letting me pet her, but I can feel that she's completely tense while I'm petting her. She's just like locked. She's like completely freaked out. It's sort of like, all right, that feels good, but it's wrong. I know it's wrong.
Does she like straighten her spine real suddenly while you pet?
No, she freaks out if I'm not careful. You know,
really?
Because I'm telling you, I can feel it in her skin. You know when you realize someone doesn't love you anymore because their skin changes? It becomes something that just sort of like that.
No.
Like, all right. Well, I can feel underneath this animal skin that is completely freaked out to its core, but it feels good. So she's letting it go for a little while, and maybe eventually she'll relax.
And
then the most beautiful of them is still completely freaked out. But I don't care. I live with it now. I've completely accepted them. I like having them around.
You enjoy them?
Sure, I do. And I feed them well, and I spoil them, and they're my little friends.
And the other crazy one is in Brooklyn now, so there's no chance of him or her coming.
No, she is in Brooklyn, working. She works in Brooklyn now. That cat is in
really?
Brooklyn.
You know, there is a train between Brooklyn and Queens. She could come back.
Well, if that cat came back to my house on the train, it was meant to be my cat. And I swear to God, if my wife ever pulled it together and we bring in, she comes out here, you know, then I got two more cats. I'm going to have a little cat farm.
Ooh, I forgot about this.
Some people hate cats.
I don't hate him. I'm a dog guy.
Yeah.
I like collies.
Well, let's talk about this. I like this whole story here about in Washington, D.C., the president expects the city to throw the bill for all, you know, at least half of
the security
for the inauguration.
Yes.
And take it out of the Homeland Security money that was allotted to the city to protect it from terrorism.
That's right. Now, here's the interesting thing about Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Congress funds their budget. So if, you know, the city fathers in D.C., and this has happened before.
Yes.
If they cross a certain line, then Congress threatens to cut their appropriations. So that they're not even in a position to say, well, you know what, we're not going to do it. Because then Bush will go to the Congress and say, hey, you know what, cut their allocation by the precise amount it costs to do the security.
Is D.C. still pretty crappy for the most part?
No.
I mean, it used to be, I know, it was a pretty dicey city for a while, except for, you know, what was fenced in for the government.
There. No. Let me tell you something about D.C. D.C. has changed the same way London has changed, the same way New York has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are pockets of homelessness, there are huge pockets of poverty. But they've built, like, these huge office buildings around all the pockets. So you got the World Bank headquarters on one street.
In the projects, right?
You got a Best Pocket Park full of homeless right downstairs.
I know. You know, it's weird when cities do that, because when I was in San Francisco, you had a lot of that. When they start to rebuild the downtown area mm-hmm. or whatnot, a lot of times they'll leave, you know, certain remnants of whatever was there before, and it makes a very strange mix.
Strange mix until they push the poor people out.
Right.
Because eventually they will push them out. So the first time a homeless guy accosts a World Bank employee, they're going.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the way that works. But see, it's interesting because Washington, say what you will about Marion Barry.
Yeah.
Marion Barry, when he was mayor of D.C., had the stones to really go up against some of these congresspeople and to argue forcefully for what he felt was just due for the people that don't live in the seat of government part of D.C.
People still love Marion Barry.
They still love Marion Barry. And you know what? Marion Barry would go toe-to-toe with these people about footing this bill.
I'd love to see that.
You know, he wouldn't care. The current mayor is a little bit different. You know, D.C. has had like a series of what I consider to be technocrat mayors over the last few years.
Uh-huh.
And these guys are like, well, whoa, what are we going to do?
Would you call Bloomberg a technocrat mayor?
To some extent, yeah. But see, the thing that people don't realize about what's going on in D.C. now
mm-hmm.
is that this is George Bush's testing ground. Do you think D.C. voted overwhelmingly for Bush last November?
No.
Absolutely. You're right. They didn't.
Yeah.
And you're going to see cities and states across the country, those so-called blue places, they're going to be footing a lot of bills during the second Bush administration. He's going to dump on them. He's going to dump on them through Medicaid and Medicare.
You mean the red places?
No, the blue places.
Yeah.
The places that went for Kerry. The municipalities.
We got a report yesterday that Tennessee is taking a hit.
Yeah, well, Tennessee's got a Democrat governor.
So you say that's retribution?
No, it's not retribution. In Tennessee's case, it's anticipation
mm-hmm.
because Tennessee had a Medicaid and Medicare crisis.
Right.
Because what Bush's end game is with Medicaid and Medicare is to give block grants to the states, let the states do with it whatever they want, which would free the states then to adjust eligibility requirements or to, for example, as in the case of Tennessee, disenfranchise 300,000 people.
All this revamping of Medicare and all this, you know, big hype around the new prescription drug bill is just crap. It's meaningless because ultimately it becomes up to the states anyways.
It becomes up to the states, and what happens is the states end up having to make the cuts rather than the federal government. The federal government will give them less, but it will be up to the states. So that way Bush is, you know, he's got a firewall between him and these cuts.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of congressmen, governors, mayors.
Who then have to foot the bill. New York is a great example of this because New York City doesn't get great reimbursement from the state for Medicaid and Medicare.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is something, you know, right now it's about the inauguration and how much D.C. is going to have to pay.
But this is
going to come, it's going to spread all over the country, and a lot of people are going to see a lot of pain.
And this is sad because, you know, these states were only allotted a certain amount of money, you know, disproportionately so in relation to Homeland Security, and now this is going to tap them out.
Yeah, it's going to tap them out.
And it's going to overextend some police hours. It's going to take money that could have been, you know, spread out over a year just so they can have their party.
Well, so that they can have what they consider to be a secure party. Because this is now going to be the city of D.C., the Metropolitan Police in Washington. All of these different city services in Washington will either have to be interrupted or augmented in order to pull this thing off. And the city of D.C. will foot the bill, whether it comes from Homeland Security or from the General Treasury. The government, the federal government, is not paying for this.
Mm.
I went to the I went to Clinton's inauguration. I went to the ball down there. I was there. I can't remember. Oh, my buddy Jim was working for him. I went to a bunch of parties. It was a pretty crazy time. We'll be back. We got a little soundbite from Terry Jones of Monty Python, who was on our show earlier. We'll talk a little bit about Iraq. We've got we got Stephanie McLuhan, Marshall McLuhan's daughter, to come talk about her father's legacy.
Yes.
All that's coming up. It's 14 past the hour at Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
The show is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's been a big day. Every day's a big day. It has to be. That's what I say. Coming up later in the hour, Stephanie McLuhan, the daughter of Marshall McLuhan and the editor of Understanding Me, Lectures and Interviews, is going to talk about her father's legacy and the mystery of Marshall McLuhan, who many of us are familiar with. We certainly, whether you know it or not, know a lot of the buzzwords that he sort of and sound bites that he created, but few of us know what they mean and what the prophecy of the McLuhan vision was, and we will talk about that later. Right now, Raymond came by wearing very baggy pants and a silly hat, and he brought us this. This is not a cabinet member, but certainly someone who is willing to do the bidding of the administration. This is Armstrong Williams, Palm Pilot, for today. 7 a.m. Wake up. Zippity-doo-dah. My, oh, my. What a wonderful day. 7:30 a.m. Breakfast. Good morning, Aunt Jemima, my special lady. 8 a.m. Take car service to work. Tell driver to avoid Martin Luther King Boulevard. Come on, man. 10 a.m. on NPR, defend Bush's handling of the war in Iraq. 4 minutes. Bill, RNC, $5,000. 11 a.m. in elevator, casually mention enthusiasm for Bush's Social Security policy. 2 minutes. Bill, RNC, $3,000. 1 p.m. lecture to black journalism students, title, Get Paid by Any Means Necessary. 3 p.m. Watch BET. Note, these people have such interesting slang. 9 p.m. Order Chinese food. This was, we were laughing earlier. All right. 9 p.m. Order Chinese food. Extol the virtues of tort reform to delivery guy. Bill, RNC, $200.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It's so funny because those of you who don't know who are just tuning in the 8 o'clock hour, we do the Bomb Pilot earlier also.
Yes.
And it's different every time. And this one was particularly funny, especially the first time. But you guys, some of you don't need to know that. I didn't have to tell you that, but I'm letting you in on the process. So the search for banned arms, for weapons of mass destruction, over, officially over. The reason we went to war, over. Didn't even exist.
Weren't no there. More WMDs.
I love the footage of guys looking for WMDs. You got every time they show footage of it, even today, it's just like they show these footage of guys fully decked out Marines kind of poking around in buckets, you know, pulling a dirty washcloth out of a bucket with a stick. Like, is this one? No, it's not. Could be. Who knows what's on that rag, on that dirty rag. You know, we talked to Terry Jones of Monty Python earlier in the show, whose book is The War on the War on Terror, which is available at our website at morningsedition.com. And he had a few things to say about Iraq.
So what occurred to me was that it's something like 150,000 people have died in the tsunami wave, whereas 150,000 Iraqis have died in Iraq because of what UK and US have done there.
Mm-hmm.
The Lancet article said there was 100,000 at least. So what it is, it's a human catastrophe on the same scale as the tsunami disaster,
yes.
And yet nobody's sort of raising money to help the dead Iraqis.
That was Terry Jones earlier on our show. He's from Monty Python, of course, if you're a Monty Python fan. We actually had Terry Gilliam on the phone as well.
On the phone with him, yeah.
That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. Also in Iraq, it seems that Prime Minister Iyad Alawi publicly acknowledged for the first time Tuesday that parts of Iraq probably won't be safe enough
for people to vote in the January 30th election, and he announced plans to boost the size of the country's army from 100,000 to 150,000 men by year's end. How the hell? I mean, half these guys don't even want to be in the army.
Yeah, they're going to keep an extra 50,000 Americans. That's how he's going to boost it to 150,000.
And now he's saying that there's some areas that are impossible to vote in, which is which is a little different than the American election, where they made it impossible to vote.
Yeah,
it's
He's softening, just like he's doing what Bush and Rumsfeld and the rest of these guys have been doing now for the last couple of months, which is softening up world opinion for the idea that not everybody's going to get a chance to cast their ballots. They just can't do it. They've been saying for a while they can't do it. The only question was whether or not enough people would be disenfranchised so the vote would seem illegitimate. What Alawi, what Bush, what Rumsfeld have long said. Remember when Rumsfeld said, well, you know, if a few people can't vote, that's okay.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
This is all part and parcel of setting folks up for the idea that you can have a legitimate election at which or in which literally millions of people might be disenfranchised.
Rumsfeld, of course, the one of the architects of the neocon death cult, is
he should have been gone.
Tremendous rationalizer. I mean, he's the guy that when there was chaos and looting and people tearing things up, he said that's what democracy looks like in its rawest form.
Rawest form, yeah.
And now basically he's saying that some people don't vote. He's almost like dismissing it. It's like some people aren't able to vote because it's too dangerous to vote, and many people are pulling out of the voting process because they don't believe in it because of the American presence there. So it's very different than him just saying, like, hey, look at America, 70 million people don't vote. I mean, some people just don't vote. They can't vote because they might get blown up.
Well, see, what is interesting to me about this, Mark,
yeah,
is that on the one hand, you have this administration telling the American people, well, hey, we went over there to, bring democracy to a country, and by the way, by inference, to a region, and yet this administration, and they've got an appointed government that is perfectly comfortable with a perverted form of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Democracy that says, and by the way, the whole rationale for troops remaining in Iraq is the whole idea, well, if we pull them out, then the terrorists win.
Right.
Well, if people in Iraq can't vote, how is that not the terrorists winning? The terrorists are the ones that have been trying to keep people from the polls.
Right.
So if you hold an election and you have no problem with the fact that large numbers of people don't vote, you're not helping the terrorists there. You're not actually handing them a victory.
Right. It's convoluted. They're just covering for. They're saying the same thing.
Yeah, they're saying the same thing. And bottom line, you at some point have to acknowledge that this process has been rushed and it is flawed.
Yeah. We got a segment here. Our guest coming up in our next segment, you might remember, her father made an appearance in Woody Allen's film Annie Hall.
Now, Marshall McLuhan deals with it in terms of it being a high intensity, you understand, a hot medium.
What do you do when you get stuck on a movie line with a guy like this behind you?
Wait a minute, why can't I get my opinion?
Is
this a free country?
He can give you. You have to give it so loud. I mean, aren't you ashamed to pontificate like that? And the funny part of it is, Marshall McLuhan, you don't know anything about Marshall McLuhan's work.
Really? I happen to teach a class at Columbia called TV, Media, and Culture. So I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan will have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny, because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here. So yeah, just let me come over here a second.
Oh, I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Boy, if life were only like this.
That's for sure. If life were only
like that.
Right? Well, Stephanie McLuhan is going to be here. She's the daughter of Marshall McLuhan. She has a new book out called Understanding Me, Lectures and Interviews. And, I remember getting this book at a used bookstore and thinking it was the Bible of some kind because I'd heard so much about it. I was a big fan of Annie Hall.
Mm-hmm.
You heard that, the message is the medium, hot media, cold media, a global village is one of his. Some people even think that feedback is one of his. It's true. And we're going to talk to her and just demystify a little of that and see what pertinence it has for us today, Mark Riley.
That's right. Stay with us. Stephanie McLuhan's next here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
7:34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition. This is Air America Radio.
Yes, it is.
So every week we're going to be with we're going to be talking with Stephanie McLuhan in just a second. But every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the 4-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, Philadelphia, birthplace of the Declaration of Independence, and according to Men's Fitness Magazine, the second fattest city in the nation. No wonder the Liberty Bell cracked.
Oh, man.
Seeing, O goddess, of the stupidity of Georgiles, son of Bushius, that brought countless ills upon the Americans. Many a brave and wise soul did it hurl deep into Hades, leaving logic, reason, and intellect as carrion food for dogs and birds, all in fulfillment of the will of Rove. Pretty good, huh? Found this old Greek book in my basement. Very Harry Potter, but put not enough measures and serpents for secret powers. Yeah, who was that? That wasn't me. Friends? In the past, I have regaled you with many accounts of the brutal war on brains. Some told of inspiring triumph. Some told of shocking defeat. Some were even dirty. Those were my favorite. But this week, the cause of reason will suffer one of its saddest blows ever. For tomorrow, January 13th, the rabid forces of fundamentalist dogma, as led by lounge of blundering Bushius, will force biology students to listen to a bunch of hoo-ha! That's right. A school district in Dover, Pennsylvania, will be the first one in America requiring teachers to mention... To mention... a bunch of hoo-ha! 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 Hoo-ha!
Mort, what is it, Mort? What's going on?
Mark, could you help me out, please?
Yeah, sure, Mort. What do you need, buddy?
When I get to the end of this line, you just read those words here.
Oh, all right. No problem.
A school in Dover... Pennsylvania will be the first one in America requiring teachers to mention...
Wash bunny slippers, return Harry Potter.
No, below that.
All right, sorry.
It again.
Okay.
The school district in Dover, Pennsylvania will be the first one in America requiring teachers to mention...
Intelligent design?
Disgusting! Intelligent design? Sounds like the title of a bad episode of Star Trek.
Like there is a bad episode.
Shut up! That a gaggle of misanthropes armed with crackpot dogma would seek to discredit Charles Darwin? Shameful. That a school district would force its teachers to present this weird sadomasochistic folklore as science? Ignominious. That I would suddenly become intrigued by such mythology? Arousing. Mark, I have here the very statement on the intelligent design that Dover High School teachers will have to read to their biology students starting tomorrow. And I paraphrase. Good morning, students. Pennsylvania academic standards require you to learn about Darwin's theory of evolution. However, his theory is not a fact. Should you care to learn about intelligent design, stay where you are. If not, simply draw attention to yourself by getting up from your seat and waiting in the re-education quad. For your ice water bath. My family and dog were threatened by two fat guys with clubs. I want to keep my job, and my mother needs a gallbladder operation. So God this, God that, whatever the hell they want. There's no hope anyway, and don't forget, you're all made in God's perfect image. Brian, that's disgusting. Get your finger out of there. That's not your finger? Ow, who threw that? What speech? Yes. Violating the constitutional separation of church and state, masking creationism as intelligent design, and making poor high school students listen to something even more boring than biology are the ingredients of George W. Bush's theology, his Xanadu. So good luck on your first day in fantasy land, Dover. But keep in mind, you pathetic losers, no amount of religion can ever replace the magical world of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Expecto Patronus! And that's today's dispatch from
the War on Brains.
Oh, my God. I felt like I just time traveled.
You made my head hurt.
You all right, Mort?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You sure?
Yeah, that was, I had two different characters in that one. That was very, very ambitious.
Okay. Nice work. Now, can you cut the lights on you? Thank you.
All right.
It's good to see you. Have a good day.
Whatever.
Yeah, all right. Oh, my God. Well, Stephanie, there you go. Talking about a mixture of medias, right now our guest, she is the daughter of Marshall McLuhan and the editor of Understanding Me, Lectures and Interviews. We're going to talk to her about her father, Marshall McLuhan, whose books include The Medium is the Message, Laws of the Media, The New Science of Gutenberg Galaxy, The Making of Typographic Man. He's a very misunderstood character, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I remember when I saw Understanding Media in the bookstore, I must have been 14 or 15, I was a fan of Woody Allen. I knew him from that movie. I knew that it was a college bookstore, so it was deep stuff. The cover was very deep. And man, when I tried to read it, I was like, why can't I understand this? He's a very, very expansive intellect, your father was. And what was he trying to do with that book, the seminal book?
Well, I think his mission, as he articulated it, was to trace the effects of the new environments mm-hmm. created by new technology on human nature.
Right.
And when that book came out, it was the early 60s. So he was postulating that television, in particular, which was a new kid on the block, was revolutionizing our ways of thinking and perceiving and behaving. In fact, completely altering human nature. And people thought he was just right off.
Because at that time, you know, television was just taking hold. They just saw it as maybe something not even less important than a radio, some sort of freak box that you could watch a movie on or something, that they would not have the impact that certainly it has now.
Well, not only that, they actually, the critics, lamented the fact that they really thought that television sort of put you to sleep, you know, dumped you down.
Yeah.
You know, they had the opposite. Instead of seeing it, you know, as addictive because it was involving and participative and stimulating. They saw it exactly the opposite way, which is sort of the same things that you're hearing out of the critics today regarding television programming like reality shows.
Yeah.
So nothing much has changed.
Right. So let's talk about these catchphrases, you know, because I remember hearing them like, you know, hot medium, cold medium, global village. There were other ones. Did he really invent feedback? Is that his phrase, feedback?
I actually don't think, I'm not sure about feedback. He was using it, but he was always relating to the computer engineers. And they were focusing on feedback with communication cybernetics. But he definitely invented the phrase global village.
Yes.
And he meant by that, as he says in the book, incidentally, you can't paraphrase McLuhan because he paraphrases himself.
Right.
He really is aphoristic. I mean, he is the master of, he used to say that if you understand what you mean, you can say it in a phrase. And so global village, he says in the book, is simply created by the instant speed of electronic information movement, which shrinks the planet to almost nothing just by the speed of communication.
Oh, that's interesting.
Full stop.
We take that for granted now.
That's right.
That, like, the fact that we're seeing live footage of anything is just part of everyday life. We almost expect it, and people, you know, drive for it. I mean, you know, it's just the disaster coverage, the tsunami coverage is a great example of that. But your father at that time, this was, you know, amazing stuff.
Well, also, I think people still are under the illusion that, or delusion that, by global village, he means sort of some place of harmony and, you know, the whole idea of village and village life. But he didn't mean that at all. So what the book does, because it's his spoken word and the pieces, either interviews or lectures, are unedited, is he says what I mean, and then he goes on to say what he means and very succinctly.
Mm-hmm.
And the medium is a message is another very misunderstood phrase.
I'm not sure I understand it.
Well, he says, well, himself, he says it's not a simple remark, but he says what he means is, every new technology creates a new environment of information services, and it's the environment that changes people. And he was saying this about television, basically. And if you think of the Internet today and the online environment, I mean, the Internet's operational. Try shutting it off and see what happens to you.
Mm-hmm.
It has completely changed our ways of thinking, behaving, perceiving. It's changed our whole culture.
Sure.
And so he was saying this again in relationship to television, and people really did think he really, you know, was a bit off the beam.
Crazy.
You know, I always thought that the development of personalized stereo, the Walkman changed people, because it was the it was giving people the ability to create a new environment for themselves. And it seems as though, and I don't know the extent to which your father spoke about this, but that kids in many instances create these environments right under the noses of adults, and it takes adults a long time to figure it out. True?
Well, I'd say in the old days, I mean, 60s and 70s, maybe even 80s, that's true. But now, all the parents or all the adults have the toys, which is probably one of the reasons kids don't want to leave home. I mean, some of the parents have internet. They have high-speed internet. They have they've got iPods.
Sure.
They've got TiVo. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got all the toys.
But they need the kids to know how to work them.
Work them, yeah.
Right?
Because I still can't set my VCR.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Come on.
I dumped it last week.
Well, when we come back, I guess, let's address some of the... Because it's weird, because he did such profound work, and you read it, and he draws a lot from the history of intellectual activity, and he brings a lot of stuff together. I just want to talk a little bit about some of that momentum in his work, and also some more about hot medium and cold medium was one of the ones that I could never quite flesh out when I was younger. And we're with Stephanie McLuhan, the daughter of Marshall McLuhan. The book is Understanding Me. It's available on our website. If you'd like to pick it up. Can we take a call or two, Larson? What do you say?
Sure, why sure.
For Stephanie, it's 866-303-2270. If you have something specific about Marshall McLuhan that's been stuck in your craw, give us a buzz, 866-303-2270. We'll be back with her in a minute. It's 45 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, we're going to land this thing. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
Our guest in studio is Stephanie McLuhan. She's the daughter of Marshall McLuhan. She is a television documentary producer and has worked in television for years, and her father was a media theorist, I would say, one of the original media theorists. His book, Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man, was one of the great tomes of the 60s, certainly, very popular. Now, let's talk about the hot medium, cold medium thing, because there was a movie called Medium Cool, right?
Yes, there was.
I think that was based on your father's language. Now, not the movie itself, but the title. What are the differences between a hot media and a cold media?
Well, he said a cool means involving. And so he said television was a cool medium because it involved the audience in the programming. And he said this in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
in the early 60s. He had no idea that that reality programming would be the sort of quintessential manifestation of that, where the audience literally gets into the act of creating the program and becomes no longer spectator, but actor almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so by cool, he meant involving. By hot, he meant, well, actually, radio, which... You can, I guess, use the examples of Rush Limbaugh or Howard Stern. However, talk radio,
mm-hmm.
I think you would have said was cool.
Yeah.
Guys. Because
we try.
Well, again, because it's involving, because it engages the listener, the audience, in the action. So by cool, the best way to look at that is cool, he always meant involving.
Okay. So he was trying to redefine words in order to define his philosophy of this
That's
stuff.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, so cool was involving. All right, and now I understand that. So what were some of the things, like we were talking about technology and how that changes the environment and thus changes the individual. Like I know, just from having cell phones, I no longer need to use my memory anymore. I mean, I'm a little concerned about the infusion of media into our lives. I mean, you have to keep certain boundaries or on some level I think it will win and we will eventually be servicing the media. That will be our job. It's almost everyone's job anyways, isn't it? Did your father have any sort of apocalyptic prophecies about man's engagement with the media that it creates?
Well, he was very optimistic about the evolution of man through his own man-made technology. He
mm-hmm.
always said technology was human,
mm-hmm.
that we made it.
Mm-hmm.
And however, he did say it was his mission to trace the effects of the new human service environments on the people that use them. And he said people who thought that it was how you used the technology rather than what it did to you, he called those people technological idiots.
Interesting.
His language. So his point was awareness and understanding of what the new technology or the new environment that technology created did to you, and then to maximize it, maximize the use. It's a very liberating thing. I think Google Scholar search, which has now been added on to just Google search. I mean, how can you say that's anything but revolutionizing our education system, our library system? It'll change the form and function of books. It'll change the answers, change the questions. It's an evolution of man, this technology.
We also have to, I'm sorry, Mark, real quick. We also have to, be careful, basically, what you're saying of how the media is using us. That's sort of like, in terms of being aware of the environment, that's sort of what you're saying.
But if you're aware of it, it's not really using you. You've got control of it. If you're aware of it, you decide how to use it.
I hope you're right.
Well, if you decide how to use it. I mean, the thing is that, the perfect example to see the effect of the media on you or the environments they create is shut it off.
Right. Mark, you want to?
Well, I'm curious about how your father saw the marketplace, the capitalist element of media, and how that impacts on, again, the creation of environments through media. I mean, bottom line, we've had people here before who say essentially that media will go after and cover any story that they think will make themselves money. True?
Yeah,
in other words, that media is capitalist driven in that it follows the money. It will cover things that they know will sell advertising time so that they make a profit.
Oh, now you're talking about media in the sense of radio, television, and newspapers.
Yeah.
Not media in the sense of a cell phone or a Google search. These are all media. These are all man-made things.
Oh, yeah.
Not just
the
news
media. No, news media I'm talking about specifically.
So you're saying news media follows money.
Yeah. News media follows money because they know that, if you look at Fox, for example, they have a particular formula that they use that has been very successful toward making them a profit, except in the case of the New York Post, which always loses money, but that's a different story.
Well, he always felt that making value judgments, and again, he says this absolutely specifically in this book, were rather futile about a technological matter. And he also said it was rather arrogant of him to make value judgments about something that affected the life of nations and millions of people. And so I think by that he wasn't sort of abnegating responsibility. He was sort of saying, so what? I mean, the power of the media is immense. It can do, negative things, and it can have negative consequences and positive consequences. It depends how you use it.
Hmm. Sorry we didn't get to your calls, Stephanie McLuhan. It was great to be with you here. The book is called Understanding Me. It's available on our website. He was a challenging intellectual, and it's sort of hard because we have a definition of media now that doesn't quite fit in to what he was, really exploring at the time. But I'm looking forward to reading some of the essays in the book. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it.
Great.
Bet.
Thank you.
There's our liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down. Here are your marching orders for today. 1. Only 5 guilt-cultivating days until Martin Luther King's Day. 2. Combat any lingering happiness by seeing Million Dollar Baby and Hotel Rwanda back-to-back. 3. Complain to news channels covering tsunami recovery that the name the Indian Ocean really should be the Native American Ocean. And 4. Write defend privacy rights on your buttocks. Go to lobby of nearest federal building and moon security cameras. Thank you for your courage, Randy Moss. 5. Quote of the day, just drop it into conversation. Oh, great. The new Homeland Security chief was lead counsel for part of the Whitewater investigation. I guess now we won't have to worry about terrorists putting up crappy condos, man. Wake up, sheeple. It's coming down. What do we got tomorrow there, Mark?
Tomorrow we've got, among other things, Malcolm Gladwell, author of Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, which is something I really enjoy doing myself.
Good at it.
Yeah, a lot of fun today, Mark.
Yeah, it was. It was a great time. I'll see you tomorrow, man.
See you tomorrow. This is Air America Radio.
And Mark Riley. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.